The Lavender Evening Dress. A few years ago, the postmaster in a village that lies beside the lonely waters of the Ramapo River, dappled by light and leaf shadow in the morning and darkened by hill shadows in the afternoon, talked often about a lithe, tawny girl with hyacinth eyes and wheat-yellow hair. He was a sophisticated gentleman, traveled and urbane, a member of a distinguished family in those parts. To atone for his sins, he said, he taught a boys' class in a Sunday school that was in session on the first day of each week after the preaching, in a tiny, weathered church back in the Ramapo Hills. From the summits of those hills, on a clear day washed by recent rain, the slim gray towers on Manhattan Island seemed to advance into sight and hang like figures long ago worked into the tapestry on the old blue sky wall. None of the boys in the Sunday school had ever entered the city on the horizon, and only a few of them had been to Hilburn or Sloatsburg in York State or any of the New Jersey towns to the west. They were a shy lot, but wild as wood animals are wild, and they found the simple lessons in Christian ethics the postmaster was trying to teach difficult at best and impossible at those times when that girl was around. She went through his class, the postmaster said, like a slow pestilence. A boy would be gone for a month, sometimes 2 months, and then he would come back on a Sunday, glowering and sheepish, and one of his schoolmates would be absent for a while. The Sunday school teacher would sometimes see him and the girl picking wild blackberries on a hillside, or on a Saturday night, walking the road, shoes in hand, to a country dance. There was much talk about the girl among the hill folk gossips, and the postmaster, whose job gave him speaking acquaintance with most of these, gathered from what they said that she was gay and hot-tempered and amoral, feeling that the general admiration gave her the privilege of disobeying the somewhat eccentric conventions of her own community. The only time he had a good look at her was during a Wednesday night prayer meeting at which, according to an announcement the previous Sunday, the contents of 3 barrels of old clothes from the members of a New York City church would be distributed. The girl came in after the service, just as the preacher beat in the head of the first barrel. She was barefoot, and it was obvious that she wore only a stained and patched calico check dress, much too small for her. She sat in the back pew and paid no attention as the usual pathetic garments that are contained in such shipments were displayed and granted to those who could argue the greatest need. There was a gasp when the preacher pulled from the middle of the second barrel a lavender evening dress covered with sequins that glinted like tiny amethysts. It was cut low off the shoulders, and as soon as the preacher saw that, he rolled it up into a shapeless bundle and held it helplessly, waiting for someone to speak for it. No one did, but the girl stood up and padded swiftly down the aisle. Without saying a word, she grabbed the dress from the good man's hands and raced out of the church. From that time on, the postmaster said, no one ever saw the girl in other costume. Rain or shine, day or night, she was a brushstroke of lavender against the brown of dirt roads, the green of hill slopes, the khaki-colored shirts and pants of whatever boy strode beside her. Frost came early that year and leaves dropped. The air was clear and the New York towers came nearer and stayed longer. The hill people were all talking about a letter that had come to the girl from cousins in New Jersey. The postmaster had told one of his Sunday school boys that the letter had come, and the next day she had stood before his window and quietly asked for it, the sequins glinting purple in the shadowy room. People who dropped in the next day said her cousins had invited her to visit them, and they had sent her the money for her bus fare. A week later, a witness regaled the postmaster with a description of the expressions on the faces of the bus passengers down on the asphalt highway 12 miles away when the girl climbed aboard, holding her long skirt about her waist. In mid-December came a cold snap, and the thermometer outside showed 18 degrees below zero when the postmaster opened his window for business. The people in the line of waiters for mail were more eager to give him the news than to receive their letters. The body of the girl in the lavender dress had been found frozen and stiff on the road a few miles above the bus stop. Returning from Jersey City, she had left the bus and begun the long walk home, but the evening dress had proved too flimsy wear for such a night. The postmaster said that after this tragedy, all the students in his class came regularly to Sunday school, and that was the end of the story of the girl. The girl froze to death about 1939, and for a decade nothing reflected doubt on the postmaster's conclusion. But now a growing number of people feel that his narrative, the truth of which is easily provable by many witnesses, has had an inexplicable consequence. Overtones that have transcended his matter-of-fact realism. For a strange report recently began its rounds of upstate towns, and particularly colleges. It had many variants, as such tales do, but in none of them was it in any way connected with the account of the girl, her dress, and her death. A factual record known only in the vicinity of her Ramapo home. And the suggestion of such a connection is made here possibly for the first time. As I heard it, two Hamilton College juniors, motoring to a dance at Tuxedo Park after sunset of a warm Indian summer Saturday on the road that runs through the valley of the Little Ramapo River, saw a girl waiting. She was wearing a party dress the color of the mist rising above the dark water of the stream, and her hair was the color of ripe wheat. The boys stopped their car and asked the girl if they could take her in the direction she was going. She eagerly seated herself between them and asked if they were going to the square dance at Stirling Furnace. The thin, tanned face with high cheekbones, the yellow hair, the flashing smile, the quicksilver quality of her gestures enchanted the boys. And it was soon a matter of amused debate whether they would go along with her to Stirling Furnace or she would accompany them to the dance at Tuxedo. The majority won, and the boys were soon presenting their new friend to the young couple who were their hosts at the park. "Call me Lavender," she said to them. "It's my nickname because I always wear that color." After an evening in which the girl, quiet and smiling, made a most favorable impression by her dancing, drifting dreamily through the waltzes in a sparkling cloud of lavender sequins, stepping more adeptly than any of the other dancers through the complications of revived square dances, Money Musk, Hull's Victory, Nellie Gray, the boys took her out to their car for the ride home. She said that she was cold, and one of them doffed his tweed topcoat and helped her into it. They were both shocked into clichés of courtesy when, after gaily directing the driver through dusty woodland roads, she finally bade him stop before a shack so dilapidated that it would have seemed deserted had it not been for a ragged lace curtain over the small window in the door. After promising to see them again soon, she waved good night, standing beside the road until they had turned around and rolled away. They were almost in Tuxedo before the chill air made the coatless one realize that he had forgotten to reclaim his property, and they decided to return for it on their way back to college the next day. The afternoon was clear and sunny when, after considerable difficulty in finding the shack, the boys knocked on the door with the ragged lace curtain over the window. A decrepit, white-haired woman answered the door and peered at them out of piercing blue eyes when they asked for Lavender. "Old friends of hers?" she asked. and the boys, fearing to get the girl into the bad graces of her family by telling the truth about their adventure of the day before, said yes, they were old friends. "Then ye couldn't have heard she's dead," said the woman. "Been in the graveyard down the road for near 10 years. Horrified, the boys protested that this was not the girl they meant, that they were trying to find someone they had seen the previous evening. "Nobody else of that name's ever lived around here," said the woman. "'Twarn't her real name, anyway. Her pa named her Lily when she was born. Some folks used to call her Lavender on account of the pretty dress she wore all the time. She was buried in it." The boys once more turned about and started for the paved highway. 100 yards down the road, the driver jammed on the brakes. "There's the graveyard," he said, pointing to a few weathered stones standing in bright sunlight in an open field overgrown with weeds. "And just for the heck of it, I'm going over there." They found the stone, a little one marked Lily, and on the curving mound in front of it, neatly folded, the tweed topcoat.